hand to drive the agency and strike fear in the hearts of political leaders. He had personal files on many of them, something he let them know. He dined and drank with presidents and senators, letting them use the FBI when it suited him, and frightening them with the FBI when that suited him. Inside the FBI, the director was the absolute center. His approach brought tremendous fame, attention, and power to the organization. It also created an environment in which the goal of most agents and supervisors in the FBI was to avoid being noticed by Mr. Hoover. Tell him what he wants to hear, then get on with your work. That mentality was hard to displace, even decades after Hoover's death. Before I was sworn in as FBI director in 2013, I spent a week shadowing Bob Mueller. Bob, a former Marine, was a bit old school as director, not given to what he saw as touchy-feely stuff. In the grueling days immediately after September 11, 2001, for example, his wife had prodded Bob to be sure his people were holding up under the stress. Early the next morning, or so I was told, he dutifully telephoned key members of his staff, whose offices were all within a 10-second walk of his, asking, "How are you doing?" When each offered the perfunctory reply of, "Fine, sir," he replied, "Good," and hung up. Mueller was characteristically disciplined about preparing me to follow him as director. During the first morning of my week of shadowing, he explained that he had arranged for me to talk with the leaders of the FBI's major divisions. I was to meet with them one-on-one, he said, and they would each brief me on their area's challenges and opportunities. Then, Mueller explained, without a hint of a smile, he would meet with me after each of these sessions to tell you what's really going on. That comment rocked me. The FBI is an institution devoted to finding the truth. Why would the director need to tell me what's really going on after each meeting? The assumption in Bob's comment was that senior officials either weren't aware of what was happening at the FBI or weren't going to be truthful to me, their new boss, about it. My guess was the latter. Many people in my experience hesitate to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth to their bosses, and for reasons that may make sense. I could hear the voices of jaded FBI veterans channeling a character in the movie The Departed. What's the upside to doing that? It can only hurt you. Bosses are like mushrooms. You keep them in the dock and you feed them shit. I admired Bob and marveled at the way he had transformed the FBI in the aftermath of 9/11, driving the organization to break down walls, overcome its heritage as solely a detective culture, and become a fully integrated member of the intelligence community. Bob had proven that it would be a mistake to break the FBI into a criminal investigative agency and a counterterrorism agency by making the FBI great at both. I was in awe of what he had done, but I also wanted to signal a more open style of leadership. I was officially sworn in as the 7th director of the FBI on September 4, 2013. After delays caused by a congressional budget fight, complete with a shutdown of the federal government for lack of funds, we held a public installation at FBI headquarters in October. President Obama was present at the ceremony, and I caught an early glimpse of what made him a compelling leader. Patrice and our kids were, of course, in attendance at the ceremony. My two older girls had brought their serious boyfriends along, and we all joined the president for a commemorative photo of the occasion. Remembering what he had learned about our group during the introductions, President Obama smiled for the first photo and then, gesturing toward the boyfriend, said, "Hey, why don't we take another without the guys? You know, just in case." He was playful as he said it, and he did it in a way that no one was offended. But I could tell he was also being thoughtful in a way few leaders are. What if things didn't work out with one or the other of these guys? Would having them in a picture with the president ruin it for the Comeys forever? So Obama gestured the boyfriends out of the shot, to our great amusement. I'm happy to report that one of the guys is now our son-in-law and the other soon will be. Though it was a small moment, what struck me about President Obama's remark is that it displayed a sense of humor, insight, and an ability to connect with an audience, which I would later come to appreciate in the president even more. These are all qualities that are indispensable in good leaders. A sense of humor in particular strikes me as an important indicator or tell about someone's ego. Having a balance of confidence and humility is essential to effective leadership. Laughing in a genuine way requires a certain level of confidence, because we all look a little silly laughing. That makes us vulnerable, a state insecure people fear. and laughing is also frequently an appreciation of others who have said something that is funny. That is, you didn't say it, and by laughing you acknowledge the other, something else insecure people can't do. President Bush had a good sense of humor, but often at other people's expense. He teased people in a slightly edgy way, which seemed to betray some insecurity in his personality. His teasing was used as a way to ensure that the hierarchy in his relationship with others was understood, a strange thing given that he was President of the United States, and it was a sure way to deter his people from challenging the leader's reasoning. President Obama could laugh with others, and, as with President Bush, poke fun at himself in some circumstances, such as when Bush told fellow C students at a commencement address, "You too can be President of the United States." Unlike Bush, though, I never saw a belittling edge to Obama's humor, which in my view reflected his confidence. The FBI director's job is much broader than may be apparent from the outside, or as depicted in the movies, where most of the director's work seems entirely focused on individual cases and capturing bad guys. The director is the CEO of an extraordinarily complex organization. Each day began very early, when the director's protective detail would pick me up for the drive to work. Though I had a security detail of deputy U.S. Marshals when I served as Deputy Attorney General during the Bush administration, my new team was made up of specially trained FBI special agents and was much larger and more intense because the threat to the FBI director is greater. Like the U.S. Marshals who protected me as Deputy Attorney General, the special agents who watched over me and my family became family, which is a good thing because we tested them as only relatives can. Once we were in Iowa for a wedding on Patrice's side. I went to bed while Patrice stayed up late playing cards with our kids and their cousins. As it typically was, my hotel was alarmed in all kinds of ways, and all around me in the hotel were agents. And as they typically did, the agents gave me a device with a button to push in the event of a dire emergency. I was afraid of this thing, and always put it far away from me in a hotel room, so I didn't accidentally touch it during the night. This night, I put it on a countertop in the outer room and went to sleep in the bedroom, far away from it. I didn't tell Patrice I had put the button on the counter in the outer room, the exact place where she was changing quietly at 2 a.m. so as not to wake me. She must have put something on top of the button, because there was pounding on the door about 5 seconds later. She opened the door a crack to see the lead agent standing at an odd angle, wearing a T-shirt and boxer shorts. He was holding his arm so she couldn't see his hand behind his back. He looked very tense. "Is everything all right, ma'am?" "Yes, I'm just getting ready for bed." "Are you sure everything is all right, ma'am?" "Yes." "Can I see the director, ma'am?" "He's sleeping in the other room. Will you check on him, please?" Patrice walked to the bedroom door, saw me, and reported back. "I see him there sleeping. He's fine." "Thank you, ma'am. Sorry to bother you." What Patrice couldn't see, but I learned the next morning, was that there were agents stacked down the wall on either side of the door, guns held low and behind their backs. She had touched the button. My bad. The FBI boasts a strong gun culture. Guns in the hands of the good guys were a regular feature of FBI life. In every staff meeting, 80% of the attendees had a gun on them. I eventually grew accustomed to seeing a pistol in an ankle holster when the deputy director crossed his legs during a meeting. After all, the deputy director is the senior special agent in the organization, and is always armed, except when he goes to the White House. As director, I too was permitted to carry a gun, but I figured that would only complicate my life. Bob Mueller had seen it the same way. Besides, I was surrounded by armed people all day long. If I wasn't safe in the hands of the FBI, then our country was really in trouble. Sean Joyce, who served as my first deputy director, became famous in the organization for hitting reply all, when some bureaucrat within the bureau sent an all-employee message instructing personnel to shelter in place or flee in the event of an active shooter in the workplace. Sean replied that any special agent who took that advice and hid or failed to run toward an active shooter would be fired. On my morning drives to work, I would read in the back of the fully armored black Suburban, preparing myself for the first two meetings of the day. But before any meetings, I would sit at my desk and read more, starting with the applications the Department of Justice was submitting to the court for electronic surveillance in FBI national security cases. Each application must be personally approved by the director, or in his absence, the deputy director. I would review the inch-thick applications, pulling from a stack that, on many mornings, was a foot high. After reviewing and signing the applications, I would read my classified intelligence briefing, bringing me up to speed on intelligence relevant to the FBI's missions to prevent terrorism and defeat foreign intelligence threats in the United States. Then I would read unclassified material relevant to our many other responsibilities. With that homework done, I was ready to meet my senior team, starting with the 6 to 10 most senior people to discuss the most sensitive classified matters, followed by a meeting where more of the FBI's leaders were admitted. I would ask the group questions and get their morning reports on subjects that covered the FBI's span: personnel, including injuries to our agents, budget, counterterrorism, counterintelligence, weapons of mass destruction, cyber, criminal cases, including kidnapping, serial killer, gang, and corruption cases, hostage rescue team deployments, congressional affairs, press, legal, training, the FBI lab, international affairs, and on and on. Most days, I would then go meet with the Attorney General to brief her or him on the most important matters. During the Obama administration, I worked with two Attorneys General, Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch. They were each intelligent and personable lawyers, and I liked them both. Holder was close to President Obama and his senior team and very attentive to the policy and political implications of the department's work. By the time I became director, his relationship with Republicans in Congress was toxic, with the Republican-led House of Representatives having voted to hold him in contempt for his failure to provide information to their satisfaction about an ATF gun trafficking investigation on the southwest border, known as Fast and Furious. The feeling of contempt seemed to be mutual. Loretta Lynch was much quieter and new to Washington. She spoke little, and when she did, frequently seemed tightly scripted. It always takes time to become comfortable in a high-profile job. I'm not sure Lynch's brief tenure gave her that time. And where Holder had a close working relationship with his Deputy Attorney General, Lynch's relationship with Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates seemed distant and strained. It was as if they and their staffs simply didn't talk to each other. My days were consumed by both emergencies and the disciplined execution of priority programs. I was trying to transform the way the FBI approached leadership, cyber, diversity, and intelligence, among other things, which required regular CEO, or director, focus to drive them forward. And the FBI is also an international enterprise, with people in every state and more than 80 countries. That meant I needed to travel to see, listen to, and speak to the people of the FBI. In my first 15 months as director, I visited all 56 FBI offices in the United States and more than a dozen overseas. I went there to listen and learn about the people of the FBI. What are they like? What do they want? What do they need? I spent hours and hours meeting them and listening to them. The first thing that struck me was that 2/3 of the FBI employees are not gun-carrying special agents. They are an extraordinarily diverse array of talented people from all walks of life, serving the FBI as intelligence analysts, linguists, computer scientists, hostage negotiators, surveillance specialists, lab experts, victim specialists, bomb technicians, and in many other roles. The 1/3 who are special agents, especially the thousands who were drawn by love of country after 9/11 to service in the FBI, are similarly diverse. Former cops and Marines, but also former teachers, chemists, therapists, clergy, accountants, software engineers, and professional athletes. Many of them look like TV special agents, tall, attractive men and women in business dress. But they come in all shapes and sizes, from crew cuts to ponytails, from ankle tattoos to hijabs, from 6'10" to 4'10". What drives them all is a palpable sense of mission. They helped me rewrite the organization's mission statement to match what was already written on their hearts. They exist to protect the American people and uphold the Constitution of the United States. I was amazed at the talent, but I was frightened by one trend. The special agent workforce since 9/11 had been growing steadily more white. When I became director, 83% of the special agents were non-Hispanic Caucasians. As I explained to the workforce, I had no problem with white people, but that trend is a serious threat to our effectiveness. in a country that is growing more diverse, which in my view is wonderful, if every agent looks like me, we are less effective. 83% could become 100% very quickly if the FBI became known as that place where white people work. I told the workforce that the challenge and the opportunity were captured in something one of my daughters said when I told her about our diversity crisis. The problem, Dad, is that you are the man. Who wants to work for the man? My daughter was right, but also wrong. Because if people knew what the men and women of the FBI are really like, and what the work is really like, they would want to be part of it. Almost nobody leaves the FBI after becoming a special agent. Whether white or black, Latino or Asian, male or female, the annual turnover is about the same, 0.5%. Once people experience the environment and the mission at the FBI, they become addicted to it and stay until retirement, despite being paid government salaries and working under incredible stress. Our challenge, I told the FBI, is simply to get out there and show more people of color and more women, that number had been stuck just below 20% for years, what the place is like, and dare them to try to be part of it. It's not rocket science, I said. The talent is out there. They just don't know what they're missing. So we made it our passion to show them. And in just 3 years, the numbers started to change in a material way. During my third year at the FBI, a huge new agent class at Quantico was 38% non-white. Our standards hadn't changed. We were just doing a better job of showing people the life they could make by joining us, which is contagious in a positive way. My travels around the country and the world taught me something else. The FBI's leaders weren't good enough. In the private sector, I had learned that the best organizations obsess over leadership talent. They hunt for it, test it, train it, and make it part of every conversation. They treat leadership talent like money. At the FBI, though, leadership was largely an afterthought. For decades, the organization counted on good people volunteering to be leaders, and then putting up with all the family moves and time at Washington headquarters that required. Fortunately, many good people volunteered. But that kind of approach was also a recipe for people becoming leaders to escape a job they weren't doing well, or people being promoted by their bosses to get rid of them. I discovered from listening to the employees that we had some great leaders, some crappy leaders, and everything in between. That was simply not acceptable for an organization as important as the FBI. I told the organization that I had an ambitious goal. The FBI would one day be the government's premier leadership factory. And private employers would count the days until an FBI leader could retire, age 50 for special agents, so they could hire them to lead. The FBI would become so good at identifying and growing leaders that all the burdens of government leadership borne by FBI families would be repaid by successful second careers in the private sector. I told our employees that the military services were great organizations, but there was no reason why the FBI shouldn't be the dominant government supplier of America's corporate leaders. I said we were going to paint a picture of what great leadership looks like, find and grow those who could be great, and teach or remove those already in leadership jobs who weren't getting it done. With broad support across the organization, I was going to drive leadership into every corner and every conversation in the FBI until we were consistently excellent across all roles and at all levels. We would teach that great leaders are, one, people of integrity and decency. 2, confident enough to be humble. 3, both kind and tough. 4, transparent. And 5, aware that we all seek meaning in work. We would also teach them that 6, what they say is important, but what they do is far more important because their people are always watching them. In short, we would demand and develop ethical leaders. I knew a bit about this because I'd arrived at the FBI, having spent decades watching leaders, reading about leaders, and trying to lead. From all that learning and all those mistakes, I knew the kind of leader I wanted to follow and the kind I wanted to be, and I set out immediately to try and set that example. On my first full day as FBI director, for example, I sat in an auditorium in front of a camera and spoke to all employees about my expectations for them and their expectations for me. I gave the talk sitting on a stool, wearing a tie but no jacket. I also wore a blue shirt. This may not seem like a big deal to outsiders, but Bob Mueller wore a white shirt every day for 12 years. Congress had extended his 10-year term for 2 extra years. Not some days or most days, every day. That was the culture, and I thought shirt color was one early small way to set a different tone. I said nothing about my shirt, but people noticed. I laid out my 5 expectations that first day and many times thereafter. Every new employee heard them, and I repeated them wherever I went in the organization. I expected they would find joy in their work. They were part of an organization devoted to doing good, protecting the weak, rescuing the taken, and catching criminals. That was work with moral content. Doing it should be a source of great joy. I expected they would treat all people with respect and dignity, without regard to position or station in life. I expected they would protect the institution's reservoir of trust and credibility that makes possible all their work. I expected they would work hard because they owe that to the taxpayer. And I expected they would fight for balance in their lives. I emphasize that last one because I worried many people in the FBI worked too hard, driven by the mission, and absorbed too much stress from what they saw. I talked about what I had learned from a year of watching Dick Cates in Madison, Wisconsin. I expected them to fight to keep a life, to fight for the balance of other interests, other activities, other people, outside of work. I explained that judgment was essential to the sound exercise of power. Because they would have great power to do good, or if they abused that power, to do harm, I needed sound judgment, which is the ability to orbit a problem and see it well, including through the eyes of people very different from you. I told them that although I wasn't sure where it came from, I knew the ability to exercise judgment was protected by getting away from the work and refreshing yourself. That physical distance made perspective possible when they returned to work. And then I got personal. There are people in your lives called loved ones because you are supposed to love them. In our work, I warned, there is a disease called get-back-itis. That is, you may tell yourself, I'm trying to protect a country, so I will get back to my spouse, my kids, my parents, my siblings, my friends. There is no getting back, I said. In this line of work, you will learn that bad things happen to good people. You will turn to get back, and they will be gone. I order you to love somebody. It's the right thing to do, and it's also good for you. I added something I learned from Stellar Wind and the torture struggle. When someone is tired, their judgment can be impaired. And when they are dragging, it's hard for them to float above a problem and picture themselves and the problem in another place in time. So I gave them another directive, sleep. When you sleep, your brain is actually engaged in the neurochemical process of judgment. It is mapping connections and finding meaning among all the data you took in during the day. Tired people tend not to have the best judgment, and it is not as hard as you may think, I added with a smile. You can multitask. You can sleep with people you love in appropriate circumstances. One day during my first week, around noon, I walked out of my huge office through my huge conference room and past the desk of Bob Mueller's administrative assistant, who would work with me for another few months. She had been there for decades and was an invaluable resource to me, but was much more familiar with a different style of leadership. "Where are you going?" she asked. "To get a sandwich," I said. "Why are you doing that?" "Because I'm hungry. I'm just going to run up to the cafeteria." "What if people try to talk to you?" she asked with a bewildered look. "I hope they talk to me." Whenever I possibly could during my 3 years, 8 months, and 5 days as FBI director, I would walk down a long hall and up a flight of stairs to the FBI headquarters cafeteria. I never wore my jacket. I asked my security detail to stay far enough away from me that people would think I was walking alone. I didn't want FBI employees to think I needed to be protected from them. No matter how I felt inside, I tried to walk with a bounce in my step, standing straight and smiling at those I passed. The way I looked at it, when the director of the FBI stepped into that cafeteria, hundreds of pairs of eyes turned to look, and every pair was asking, in some form, the same question. "So how are we doing?" The answer from my face and posture had to be, "We're doing just fine. It's all going to be okay." I also never cut the line. Even when I wished I could, or even when I was in a hurry, I stood and waited as people in front of me ordered panini, which take forever, by the way. I thought it was very important to show people that I'm not better than anyone else, so I waited. The wait in line also allowed me to interview people. I would turn to the person next to me and ask them to tell me their story, including what they liked about their job at the FBI. I learned a tremendous amount from these many conversations. One lesson was that I wasn't the big deal I thought I was. One day after I'd been on the job for close to a year, I turned to the guy behind me and asked him about himself. I learned that he worked on computer servers. He said he'd been with the FBI for 3 years, and what he liked best about the agency was that he could get experience and responsibility far beyond what the private sector offered someone his age. There was an awkward pause, and he probably thought he needed to be polite, so he asked, "How about yourself?" "I'm the director," I replied. Bobbing his head side to side to emphasize his question, he asked, "Director of..." "Dude," I said, "I'm the director of the FBI. You work for me." Another awkward pause. Finally, he said, "Oh, you look so different online." That evening, I went home and told Patrice that story. "That should happen to you every day," she said with a laugh. Before I became FBI director, I worked at Bridgewater Associates, which aspires to build a culture of complete transparency and honesty. I learned there that I could sometimes be a selfish and poor leader. Most often that was because I was hesitant to tell people who worked for me when I thought they needed to improve. The best leaders are both kind and tough. Without both, people don't thrive. Bridgewater's founder, Ray Dalio, believes there is no such thing as negative feedback or positive feedback. There is only accurate feedback, and we should care enough about each other to be accurate. By avoiding hard conversations and not telling people where they were struggling and how they could improve, I was depriving them of the chance to grow. My squeamishness was not only cowardly, it was selfish. If I really care about the people who work for me, if I create the atmosphere of deep personal consideration I want, I should care enough to be honest, even if it makes me uncomfortable. I should, of course, still consider the best way to deliver the message. There is a right time and a right way for every conversation. If someone's mom just died, that is not the day to be accurate, but I was honor-bound to find a way to have that conversation. Effective leaders almost never need to yell. The leader will have created an environment where disappointing him causes his people to be disappointed in themselves. Guilt and affection are far more powerful motivators than fear. The great coaches of team sports are almost always people who simply need to say, in a quiet voice, "That wasn't our best, now was it?" And his players melt. They love this man, know he loves them, and will work tirelessly not to disappoint him. People are drawn to this kind of leader, as I was drawn all those years ago to Harry Howell, the grocer. A leader who screams at his employees or belittles them will not attract and retain great talent over the long term. At the FBI, I spoke often about LeBron James. Even though I don't know the man personally, I talked about him for two reasons. First, I believe he is the best basketball player in the world today. Second, he is never satisfied he is good enough. I've read that he spends every off-season working on some part of his game to improve it. At first glance, that seems crazy. He's already better than everybody else. But it makes complete sense when you consider his perspective. He isn't measuring himself against the other players. He's measuring himself against himself. The best leaders don't care much about benchmarking, comparing their organization to others. They know theirs is not good enough and constantly push to get better. Early in my term as director, when I had declared that the FBI's leadership culture needed to improve, someone handed me a survey showing we had the second best leadership survey results among the 17 agencies in the United States intelligence community. I returned the survey, explaining that I didn't care. I wasn't measuring us against them. I was measuring us against us, and we weren't nearly good enough. The tough and kind leader loves her people enough to know they can always improve their game. She lights a fire in them to always get better. I knew there were other areas where we could improve, and I suggested to the entire workforce that they read Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham jail, one of the most important things I ever read. Inspired in part by theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, King's letter is about seeking justice in a deeply flawed world. I have reread it several times since first encountering it in college. Because I knew that the FBI's interaction with the civil rights movement, and Dr. King in particular, was a dark chapter in the Bureau's history, I wanted to do something more. I ordered the creation of a curriculum at the FBI's Quantico Training Academy. I wanted all agent and analyst trainees to learn the history of the FBI's interaction with King, how the legitimate counterintelligence mission against communist infiltration of our government had morphed into an unchecked, vicious campaign of harassment and extralegal attack on the civil rights leader and others. I wanted them to remember that well-meaning people lost their way. I wanted them to know that the FBI sent King a letter blackmailing him and suggesting he commit suicide. I wanted them to stare at that history, visit the inspiring King Memorial in Washington, D.C., with its long arcs of stone bearing King's words, and reflect on the FBI's values and our responsibility to always do better. The FBI Training Division created a curriculum that does just that. All FBI trainees study that painful history and complete the course by visiting the memorial. There, they choose one of Dr. King's quotations from the wall. Maybe, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." Or, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy." And then write an essay about the intersection of that quotation and the FBI's values. The course doesn't tell the trainees what to think. It only tells them they must think about history and institutional values. Last I checked, the course remains one of the highest-rated portions of their many weeks at Quantico. To drive the message home, I obtained a copy of the October 1963 memo from J. Edgar Hoover to Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, seeking permission to conduct electronic surveillance of Dr. King. At the bottom of the single-page memo, which is only 5 sentences long and without meaningful facts, Kennedy's signature grants that authority, without limit as to time and place. I put the memo under the glass on the corner of the desk where every morning I reviewed applications by the FBI and the Department of Justice to conduct national security electronic surveillance in the United States. As Hoover did, I was required to personally sign an application. The difference was that our applications went to a court and were often thicker than my arm. As I would explain to employees, it is a pain in the neck to get permission to conduct that kind of surveillance, and it should be. I kept the Hoover memo there not to make a critical statement about Hoover or Kennedy, but to make a statement about the value of oversight and constraint. I have no doubt that Hoover and Kennedy thought they were doing the right thing. What they lacked was meaningful testing of their assumptions. There was nothing to check them. It is painful to stare openly at ourselves, but it is the only way to change the future. The FBI rank and file reacted very positively to this and other initiatives, something I could see in their annual anonymous rating of me across the organization. But I knew some FBI alumni were confused as to why I seemed to be attacking the organization I led. But transparency is almost always the best course. Getting problems, pain, hopes, and doubts out on the table so we can talk honestly about them and work to improve is the best way to lead. By acknowledging our issues, we have the best chance of resolving them in a healthy way. Buried pain never gets better with age. And by remembering and being open and truthful about our mistakes, we reduce the chance we will repeat them. Harry Truman once said, "The only thing new in the world is the history you don't know." Humans tend to do the same dumb things and the same evil things again and again because we forget. Chapter 9. The Washington Listen. Let me not seek as much to be understood as to understand. Peace Prayer of St. Francis. Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray. Those are the names of some of the black civilians who died during encounters with the police in 2014 and 2015. Those encounters were captured on video, and those videos went viral, igniting communities that have been soaked in the flammable liquid of discrimination and mistreatment. And although it didn't involve video of the shooting, One death in particular rocked the country. On August 9, 2014, a young black man named Michael Brown was shot and killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, touching off weeks of unrest in that community and bringing unprecedented attention in America to the use of deadly force by police against black people. In the months after the shooting, the federal investigation discovered some important truths. The Ferguson police have been engaged in a pattern of discriminatory behavior directed at African Americans, and the town governance, from ticketing practices to the bail system, operated to oppress black people. As in so many American towns and cities, the police needed to change before African Americans would trust them. It was understandable that Michael Brown's death was a tragic spark that ignited a powder keg built by oppressive policing in that community. But in the end, the Department of Justice found there wasn't sufficient evidence to charge that police officer with federal civil rights crimes for shooting Michael Brown. FBI agents knocked on hundreds of doors throughout Ferguson and discovered not only that there was not sufficient evidence, but also that early media accounts of the shooting were factually wrong and misleading. Contrary to what most of the public had heard or thought they had seen, there was reliable evidence that Michael Brown was not surrendering when he was shot, and there was DNA evidence that he had assaulted the officer and tried to take his gun. In one sense, those conclusions by federal investigators, reached months after Michael Brown's death, didn't matter. Most of the world had already heard false reports and believed Brown was gunned down while surrendering with his hands up. In the time it took for the truth to get its boots on, false information had circled the earth many times. The Department of Justice's conclusions were important, but late. By spring 2015, when the department completed its work and publicly released a detailed account of the investigation and its conclusions, several highly publicized videotaped encounters between police and African Americans had dramatically increased the focus on police use of force. Millions watched videos of violent police encounters, including NYPD officers killing Eric Garner with a chokehold, and Cleveland police officers shooting 12-year-old Tamir Rice in a city park. Millions more watched as Walter Scott was murdered by a South Carolina police officer, who after shooting Scott in the back, was then captured on video appearing to alter the crime scene to cover up what he had done. Still more watched Baltimore officers drag Freddie Gray into the back of a police van for a ride he did not survive. These tragic deaths dominated perceptions of the police. They swamped and overshadowed millions of positive, professional encounters between citizens and police officers, and extraordinary anger was building toward all uniformed law enforcement. During this volatile period, in December 2014, two NYPD officers were executed by a killer claiming to be acting in retaliation by putting wings on pigs. President Obama asked me to attend one of the NYPD funerals as his representative. As I spoke to the family of Officer Wenjun Liu in a small Brooklyn funeral home, the grief was so thick as to be suffocating. Outside, thousands of stone-faced police officers stood for miles in a cold wind. I had felt the pain and anger of black communities since Ferguson, and now I could feel the pain and anger of law enforcement. Police officers didn't feel safe or appreciated on the streets they were trying to protect, and communities didn't trust the police. Law enforcement and the black community in America have long been separate, parallel lines, closer in some communities, farther apart in others. But now those lines were arcing away from each other everywhere. Each video depicting the death of a civilian at the hands of police driving one line away, each killing of a police officer arcing the other line away. I struggled with whether there was something I could say or do that would make a difference, to help bend the lines back toward each other. The FBI was a federal investigative agency, but we were deeply involved in local policing, both as a trainer of police leaders and as a key partner to uniform law enforcement. I decided I could do two things. I could use the high profile of the director's job to say some things I believed to be true, in the hope it would foster better dialogue. And then I could use the FBI's nationwide presence to drive that dialogue. So in February 2015, I went to Georgetown University and talked about four hard truths that all of us need to know. First, I said, we in law enforcement need to acknowledge the truth that we have long been the enforcers of a status quo in America that abused black people. We need to acknowledge our history because the people we serve and protect cannot forget it. Second, we all need to acknowledge that we carry implicit biases inside us, and if we aren't careful, they can lead to assumptions and injustice. Third, something can happen to people in law enforcement who must respond to incidents resulting in the arrest of so many young men of color. It can warp perspectives and lead to cynicism. Finally, I said, we all must acknowledge that the police are not the root cause of the most challenging problems in our community's worst neighborhoods, but that the actual causes and solutions are so hard that it is easier to talk only about the police. I then ordered all 56 FBI field offices around the country to convene meetings between law enforcement and communities to talk about what is true and how to build trust needed to bend those lines back toward each other. It is hard to hate up close, and the FBI could bring people up close. The public reaction to the Georgetown speech was positive. As a white FBI director with long law enforcement experience, I could say things about law enforcement history and biases that others couldn't, and many police chiefs were privately grateful. But the lines stayed far apart, and by the middle of 2015, something ominous was happening. In late summer, more than 40 of the country's largest cities reported to the FBI that they were experiencing jumps in the number of murders starting in late 2014. What was particularly unusual about the numbers was that the rise in the murder rate wasn't uniform and didn't follow any obvious pattern. In fact, about 20 of the 60 largest cities in America were not seeing increases. Some had seen fewer murders. And the cities, some with huge increases, some without, were mixed together on the American map. Even while I was speaking at Georgetown, murders were climbing, and the victims were overwhelmingly young black men. The cities with dramatic increases had different gang problems and different illegal drug patterns. What they appeared to have in common were large and concentrated poor black neighborhoods where more young black men were being shot and killed by other young black men. I was hearing from police leaders that the increases might be connected to changes in behavior among police and civilians, connected to the narratives driven by viral videos. I didn't know for sure, and I didn't have the expertise or the data to figure it out, but I was determined to raise the issue. It would be too easy for the country to ignore more deaths of black men, too easy for the country to drive around the problem, because it was happening to those people over there. Somebody had to say something to force a conversation about what was happening. My fondest wish was to be wrong and find out that something simple explained the numbers, or that this was some random but widespread statistical anomaly. At the same time, the Obama administration and an interesting alliance of liberal Democrats and libertarian Republicans in Congress were working together to reduce punishments for some federal criminal offenses. It was one of the only policy areas on which some self-described Tea Party Republicans and President Obama could agree. I had no heartburn with the specific proposals, which all seemed quite modest and reasonable to me. But a national conversation about murder spikes and what might be causing it was the last thing advocates of criminal justice reform wanted. I understood that. But I just couldn't bear to be silent about the deaths of so many young black men and the possibility that broad changes in human behavior might be some part of that. So I talked about the subject again in Chicago in late October 2015. I talked about the lines of community and police arcing away from each other and the competing narratives pushing the lines apart, and used two popular Twitter hashtags to make my point. I said, I actually see an example and a demonstration of that arcing through hashtags, through the hashtag Black Lives Matter and the hashtag Police Lives Matter. Of course, each of those hashtags and what they represent adds a voice to an important conversation. But each time somebody interprets the hashtag Black Lives Matter as anti-law enforcement, one line moves away. And each time that someone interprets the hashtag Police Lives Matter as anti-black, the other line moves away. I actually feel the lines continuing to arc away and maybe accelerating, incident by incident, video by video, hashtag by hashtag, and that's a terrible place for us to be. Then I turn to the rising murders, saying that just as those lines are arcing away from each other, and maybe, just maybe, in some places because those lines are arcing away from each other, we are seeing huge jumps in homicide in vulnerable neighborhoods, and the dead are almost all young black men. I said that communities, academics, and law enforcement need to demand answers. I reviewed some of the theories I had heard, guns, drugs, gangs, release of jailed offenders, and said none of them seemed to explain the map and the calendar, all over the United States and all at the same time. I then said I had heard another theory. Almost nobody says it on the record, but police and elected officials are saying it quietly to themselves all over the country, and it's the one theory that, to my mind, to my common sense, does explain the map and the calendar. And of the explanations I've heard, it's the one that makes the most sense to me. Maybe something has changed in policing. I said, I don't know for sure whether that's the case. I don't know for sure that even if it is the case, it explains it entirely. But I do have a strong sense that some part of what's going on is likely a chill wind that has blown through law enforcement over the last year. I finished with a plea by saying this. We need to figure out what's happening and deal with it now. I've heard some folks suggest that it's too early. It's only October. We should wait to the end of the year and then see what the crime stats look like. I refuse to wait, especially given the information that we have from all the big city chiefs, and especially because these are not just data points, these are lives. Law enforcement leaders must not wait to push their folks to police well. By that I mean firmly, fairly, and professionally. And as important, community leaders must not wait to demand and assist those officers in policing well, and to insist those officers get the space, time, and respect to do it effectively and professionally. I knew these comments would anger some people in the Obama administration, but I felt strongly that the FBI director should be an independent voice on criminal justice issues like this. Independence is what President Obama told me he was looking for when he selected me. Issues of crime, race, and law enforcement are complicated and emotional, but they don't get better by not talking about them. I was right about one thing. Everybody was upset by my comments. In fact, more people than I expected. My goal had been to highlight a serious problem, give a nuanced treatment of it, and ignite a discussion about possible causes and solutions. I wanted to force a conversation about a hard thing. I wanted to stimulate people to ask difficult questions about what could be true, to drive collection of data, and to push for the study of that data. And I hoped that it might even change behavior and save lives by encouraging better policing and more supportive community relationships. Instead, I got to see another demonstration of tribalism in America. Police unions complained I was blaming cops and calling them cowards. Voices from the left said I was asserting a Ferguson effect without evidence and it couldn't possibly be true. They said I was against scrutiny of the police. Voices from the right said the country was experiencing a murder epidemic and blamed President Obama. Too few people asked, what is true? Too few people actually considered the possibilities and asked what might be going on, even if they believed I was out to lunch. Instead, folks rushed to their team, their side. Very few voices in the public square took the time to ask, so what is this guy worried about, and what is he saying exactly? One person, in the very center of the public square, did. A day or two after I returned from Chicago, my chief of staff came in to tell me the president would like to speak with me in the Oval Office. No topic was given, and no information on who else would be there. It turned out to be just the two of us. My first meeting alone with President Obama. Until I met my wife, I didn't know what real listening was. Neither, at least in my experience, do most people in Washington, D.C. To them, listening is a period of silence, where someone else talks before you say what you were planning to say all along. We see these exchanges in nearly every debate on television. It's the candidate sitting on the stool, waiting for the light to go on, then standing up and saying their prearranged talking points, while someone else says their prearranged talking points back at them. It's just words reaching ears, but not getting into a conscious brain. That's the Washington listen. My marriage has taught me that what I thought of as listening really isn't listening either. Like a lot of people, I thought that listening involves sitting silently as someone else talked and then perceiving what they say. I was wrong. True listening is actually that period of silence and allowing someone's words to reach your conscious brain. But it also includes something else that's a little weird. With your posture, your face, and your sounds, you signal to someone, I want what you have. I need to know what you know. I want you to keep telling me the things you're telling me. Two good friends talking to each other is a stenographer's worst nightmare. They are talking over each other. When one is speaking formed words, the other is making sounds. Uh-huh. Ooh, I know. Yep, yep. Oh, I've seen it. Yep, they'll do that. They're listening to each other in a way where each is both pushing information to the other and pulling information out of the other. Push, pull, push, pull. When they're really connecting, it actually runs together. Push, pull, push, pull. That's real listening. To be effective at the FBI, I spent a lot of time listening, something we all struggle to do well. It is hard for leaders to listen well because it requires us to be vulnerable, to risk our superior position. Barack Obama surprised me by picking me as FBI director. And this is where Barack Obama surprised me yet again. He was an extraordinary listener, as good as any I've seen in leadership. In various meetings with the president, I watched him work hard to draw as many viewpoints as possible into a conversation, frequently disregarding the hierarchy reflected in seating arrangements, principals at the table, lower-ranked folks in chairs against the wall. I can recall a meeting in the Situation Room about a classified technology topic where President Obama asked some Silicon Valley whiz kid without a tie sitting against the wall what he thought of the discussion the formally dressed leaders of the nation's military and intelligence agencies had just had at the table. The shaggy dude then contradicted several of us. Obama hunted for points of view. Maybe it was a legacy of his life as a professor, cold calling someone in the back row. This approach often led to chaotic conversations, but it allowed him to hear views that in the Bush administration would have been watered down by rank or by fear of being teased. No guy without a tie would have been in the Bush Situation Room, and if he somehow snuck into a back row seat, he would not be called upon, and if he spoke anyway, he would be mocked for his attire. Obama had the ability to really discuss something, leveling the field to draw out perspectives different from his own. He would turn and face the speaker, giving them long periods without interruption to share their view. And although he was quiet, he was using his face, his posture, and sometimes small sounds to draw the person out. He was carefully tracking what they said, something he would prove, by asking questions when they finished. The questions were often drawn from throughout the minutes he had been listening. President Obama was also more than willing to discuss things that people weren't sure he wanted to hear. I learned this firsthand after I made those controversial comments about law enforcement and race. It turns out they caused considerable concern at the White House. When I joined President Obama in the Oval Office after returning from Chicago, I discovered that he had intentionally excluded his senior staff and the Justice Department from the room. It was to be our first one-on-one meeting in the 26 months I had been FBI director. As I walked through the door by the grandfather clock and saw nobody else, I thought maybe I was about to get an ass-chewing. The president sat in his usual seat, the armchair to the right of the fireplace. I sat on the couch just to his left. There was no chewing out. Instead, the president began the meeting by saying, I asked you to come because I know your head and your heart, and I want to understand what you're seeing and thinking. We then spoke with each other for about an hour, and I used the word with intentionally. It was a true conversation with pushing and pulling, pushing and pulling. The president asked a question that invited an open-ended response. What are you seeing and what's worrying you? I talked for about 10 minutes. Talked about the map and the calendar. More than 40 of the nation's 60 largest cities seeing rises in killings of young black men, all coming at the same time, in a pattern that didn't line up with other crime trends, and mixed geographically with large cities that were not seeing a murder increase. I explained my worry that most of the country could just ignore the problem, because it was black men dying, and only in those neighborhoods. I also noted my concern that the increases were connected to changes in behavior following the viral videos. I said my goal was to call it out, raise the question of whether the police and the communities were pulling back from each other in small ways that added up to something big. I said my hope was that by raising the question, I could help change behaviors if that was what was happening. When I was done, he expressed appreciation for my focus on the issue, then laid out some of the things I had said publicly that struck a discordant note with him. For example, I had used the term weed and seed to describe what I thought was needed, pulling out the bad guys and working to grow something healthy in the space created by the arrests. He asked, "Can you see how that might sound to black people? Calling young men in their community weeds?" He spoke of how black people often resented a trade-off that their circumstances forced them to make. They welcomed the security police bring, but resented the conditions that make that police presence necessary in their neighborhoods. Poor schools, few jobs, addiction, and broken families. I responded that it hadn't occurred to me that people of color might hear my words that way. I hadn't taken the time to consider how the term, weed and seed, one we had been using in law enforcement for decades, might strike people, especially black people at a challenging time. I was trapped in my own perspective. A black person, who happened to be President of the United States, helped me see through other eyes. We talked about the impact on black communities from the extraordinarily high percentage of black men in the criminal justice system, and how poor a job our country has done to prepare those in prison to return to productive lives. Although I agreed that the jailing of so many black men was a tragedy, I also shared how a term he used, mass incarceration, to describe what in his view was a national epidemic of locking up too many people, struck the ears of those of us who had dedicated much of our lives to trying to reduce crime in minority neighborhoods. To my ears, the term mass incarceration conjures an image of World War II Japanese internment camps, where vast numbers of people were herded behind barbed wire. I thought the term was both inaccurate and insulting to a lot of good people in law enforcement who cared deeply about helping people trapped in dangerous neighborhoods. It was inaccurate in the sense that there was nothing mass about the incarceration. Every defendant was charged individually, represented individually by counsel, convicted by a court individually, sentenced individually, reviewed on appeal individually, and incarcerated. That added up to a lot of people in jail, but there was nothing mass about it, I said. And the insulting part, I explained, was the way it cast as illegitimate the efforts by cops, agents, and prosecutors joined by the black community to rescue hard-hit neighborhoods. He responded by urging me to see how black people might experience law enforcement and the courts very differently, and that it was hard to blame them for seeing the jailing of so many black men in numbers wildly greater than their proportion of the population as anything other than mass. When we were done, I was smarter, and I hoped that in some small way I'd helped him see things from a different perspective as well. Our discussion was the total opposite of the Washington Listen. Each of us actually took the time to really understand a different way of looking at something, and with a mind open to being convinced. President Obama would never have considered such a conversation if he did not have enough confidence in himself to show humility. In fact, if I saw any hint of imbalance with President Obama as a leader, it was on the confidence side of the scale, and I would see it in grappling with the hardest problem I encountered in government, encryption. Before I became FBI director, Edward Snowden, a contractor at the National Security Agency, stole a huge trove of classified data about the NSA's activities and then shared a very large amount of that data with the press. One obvious result of this theft was that it dealt a devastating blow to our country's ability to collect intelligence. Another result was that in the year after his disclosures, bad actors across the world began moving their communications to devices and channels that were protected by strong encryption, thwarting government surveillance, including the kind of court-authorized electronic surveillance the FBI did. We watched as terrorist networks we long had been monitoring slowly went dark, which is a scary thing. In September 2014, after a year of watching our legal capabilities diminish, I saw Apple and Google announce that they would be moving their mobile devices to default encryption. They announced it in such a way as to suggest, at least to my ears, that making devices immune to judicial orders was an important social value. This drove me crazy. I just couldn't understand how smart people could not see the social costs to stopping judges, in appropriate cases, from ordering access to electronic devices. The Apple and Google announcement came on the eve of one of my regular quarterly sessions with the press corps that covered the FBI and the Department of